relief factor, pain relief that's natural, pain relief that works, and pain relief that attacks the source of the pain. That's the experience of tens of thousands of Americans who are taking Relief Factor right now. See their incredible video endorsements at ReliefFactor.com and then order your three-week quick starter pack for just $19.95. That's less than a dollar a day. Find out if it can work for you like it works for me by ordering your three-week quick starter pack today. ReliefFactor.com, ReliefFactor.com. Be the next success story.
I'm nervous, guys. This is a tough one-on-one. No, President Trump isn't back, although, what's it been? 2-3 weeks since he's been on, Mr. G. Get on that. Contact Mar-a-Lago. But now, the real boss is in town. It's the first time she's been in our new studio. The one and only, we call her the First Lady of America First. Katie Gorka, welcome to One-on-One.
Husband, I am so happy to be here.
So
really exciting.
Should we talk about? Should we talk about marital bliss? How tidy I am at home? How much ironing I do? What should we discuss? Don't laugh. This is serious stuff.
I love the fact that you do the dishes in the evening. That's all I care about.
50% of the time.
That's enough for me.
All right, you heard it, guys. Happy wife, happy life. Do half the dishes in the evening and you're almost perfect. Seriously, this is a very special interview. Why? Because I get to share with you my love of my life and to talk about the incredible work she's been doing, not only in the administration as a presidential appointee, the Department of Homeland Security, then the press secretary for Customs and Border Protection, where you worked with Mark Morgan, who's a huge supporter of the show, and then now as a senior fellow at the Heritage Foundation for Civil Society. But let's begin at the beginning. I've known you for quite some time.
Yes, you have.
And we met in Eastern Europe, in Romania.
Yes.
I was working for the Hungarian government defense ministry after the fall of communism. You were working for a New York think tank helping in the democratization process in Central Europe. Share a little bit about your journey, because when I met you, allegedly, there were only two charities you gave to, AIDS charity and a gun control charity.
Yes, gun control and Gay Men's Health Crisis. Yes.
Gay Men's Health Crisis and Gun Control, Inc. And I think your life has changed somewhat in the last 26 years.
Yes, it has.
Why? Talk to us your journey and how you look at this nation we live in now.
Well, I think the important thing is that, like so many young people who got a terrible education overall, I did not understand this country at all. I did not love this country. I would not say I was a patriot. I remember growing up in a part of Long Island. I remember maybe when I was about six, a 4th of July parade with the streamers woven through my bike spokes and the Good Humor ice cream. And that's kind of the last act of patriotism I remember, because you go to school. I mean, granted, this was a while ago, but let's say this would have been, you know, I was growing up in the 70s. It was not a great time to be an American. We were tearing apart so many of the institutions that are just critical to human flourishing and to a human's well-being and critical to children. But the church had already been greatly weakened. Marriage had been greatly weakened. My mom subsequently told me that she and my dad had gone to marriage counseling and they were basically advised, seek your own happiness.
Meaning get divorced.
Meaning go your own way. Right. And if that's going to make you happier, then do it, right? And I think she has regrets about that, that was the advice that was given to her. So it was just a really hard time to grow up. And then the amazing thing that happened is 1989.
So let's fill in the gap there. So you grow up in that atmosphere, 60s and 70s, the rise of the new left. You go to college, you get a master's degree in the London School of Economics. You're living in New York. Then the wall falls. And then what? You have a crazy idea to do what?
Yeah, I had a crazy, I had this deep compulsion that this was an extraordinary moment in history, and I wanted to go there to see it and to see what was happening. And
how communism was falling.
And what it was like for people to live through this extraordinary transition, right? What was it like to go from communism to democracy? So As a liberal, I would say, as an unpatriotic liberal, I went to Central and Eastern Europe. And that was the start of my awakening.
And then what did you do? Because you traveled around the whole region.
I traveled around the whole region.
Who did you meet with?
Yeah, I interviewed, I think, over 600 people, everything from coal miners to presidents.
So, like, people from Solidarity in Poland.
Everything, yeah.
On the front line of the collapse.
Yeah, all kinds of dissidents and new leaders and the new presidents. And it was just an incredible awakening. And I want to say it did not happen overnight. It really took time. And, you know, then obviously I met you.
Hang on. Slow down. We'll get to that in a second. But let's talk about how your understanding of America changed as you're sitting 4,000, 5,000 miles away in the Baltic states, in post-communist Poland, in Hungary, traveling through the region. What did you learn from the people you spoke to who had been captives of a communist system in all of those countries, and their understanding of freedom, liberty, human rights that made you think differently about America? Walk us through that journey.
Okay, I'll tell you one story that was really defining for me is somebody in the Romanian government had made the opportunity for me to interview the president, Petru Roman, at the time.
So the post-communist government.
Post-communist president. And this guy who was his chief of staff, because I was nobody. I just came in with a business card, which had a made-up book title, because that was my aspiration, was to write a book about this. And that was my only credential. And so this guy said to me, the president's chief of staff said, okay, I've arranged for you to interview the president, but I've told him you work for the Ford Foundation. So please go in with that story. And that was just a shocker to me, right?
Right.
I mean, here's a guy. And I have to preface it by saying, before the interview, you know, I had done this like hour-long interview with him, the chief of staff, and he was great. He was quoting Madison, he was quoting Hamilton, and various others.
A Romanian,
yes,
in Bucharest is quoting Madison and Hamilton,
yes,
to you.
Right, and it's almost as if to prove that
his
he was really on the right side.
But we're Democrats.
But it was all belied by the fact that he was willing to lie to his own boss,
right,
to the president of the country.
It's very Eastern European.
Totally, isn't it?
Right.
Yeah. I mean, that was a part of the awakening. I beyond that, I can't pinpoint any one thing. I mean, the reason I was sort of jumping ahead to when you and I were, and we'll come back to it, but I think where I really started to absorb sort of the seriousness of it and to really understand America was actually when we lived there. When we lived in Hungary, you know, you were there. We lived in Hungary for 12 years.
Raised our family there.
We raised our children there. And particularly the last 5 years when we lived in a beautiful small town, and really learning firsthand how damaged people still were from the experience of communism. I mean, people would still whisper. People were still, like, people would not use their full voice a lot of times.
This is the 1990s. This
Like
a decade after the fall of communism. People would be nervous about talking about politics or sensitive issues.
Absolutely. And I remember the incredible experience when you served on the committee against the Prime Minister of Hungary, because it had come out that he'd been an officer in the secret police, and you served on that committee that was investigating him, and you suddenly became kind of an overnight news story yourself because you were speaking out. And I thought, our friends would call me up and say, so good for Sebastian to speak up. We're so proud of him. And instead, our friends called me up and said, you need to be careful.
Yeah.
This is not smart. And that was the real awakening.
Not only that, let me just add a little story to your stories. Our American friends, some of our closest American friends who worked in the embassy, didn't understand why on earth would I, with your support, want to investigate the secret police history of the new prime minister. Let's just do business with them. This is a new age and the crimes of the past are irrelevant. That was shocking, wasn't it? When good friends who are Americans say, communism, forget about the crimes.
And here's what's really important. He was not just in the secret police, but he was in the part of the secret police that was investigating domestically. He was spying on his fellow Hungarians, which is pretty much the greatest crime you can commit in the communist world. And the attitude of the U.S. Embassy at the time was, the people elected him. Who were we to say?
Right.
Who cares what he did?
Yeah, he wasn't fighting America during the Cold War. He was spying on fellow Hungarians, getting them in trouble, getting them interrogated, getting them arrested. Okay, I have one thing to say. If you don't write that book with the 600 interviews, I've now publicly shamed you in front of 3 million people. Will you write that book, Katie Gorka?
Okay, yes, I will.
It worked. We got her in studio. I got the commitment. I got the witnesses, the team outside, all of you. She has said it. We're going to give her 12 months. You got it, guys? I'm having fun here. If you enjoy this show as much as we love making it for you with this massive team we have here, I think there's four of us, then make sure you are subscribed. Go to your favorite podcast platform. Go to Spotify. Plug in my name, Sebastian Gorka. It's absolutely free. Never miss an episode. Write a review. It helps us with those dastardly algorithms. And be sure that you never, ever miss an episode. If you haven't done so already, be sure to register for our Stand With Israel tour later this year. 10 days in the Holy Land with my superb Salem colleague, Dinesh D'Souza, and his lovely wife, Debbie. We are literally going to be there walking where our Lord and Savior walked the earth, on the shores of the Sea of Galilee, standing there at the Temple Mount, at the Garden of Gethsemane. If you've never been to Israel, you've got to come and join us. If you've been before, it doesn't matter. You haven't been with me and Dinesh. Israel has dropped all of their COVID requirements. I'm not vaccinated. And you're not, right? And we're both going. So join us for the trip of a lifetime. Register today. Reserve your places. Call 855-565-5519. StandWithIsraelTour.com. That's 855-565-5519. StandWithIsraelTour.com. Don't miss it. Dear friends, you know my friend Mike Lindell has a passion to help everyone get the best sleep of their lives. He didn't stop by simply creating the best pillow. Now Mike has done it again by introducing his My Slippers. For a limited time, you will get $90 off a pair of My Slippers. This blowout sale of the year won't last, so order now. They took over 2 years to develop. They're designed to wear indoor and out. I've already worn out my first pair of My Slippers, and they're made with the same amazing My Pillow foam and impact gel to help prevent fatigue and lined with real suede. Call 800-829-8468. Use promo code Gorka for that massive discount, or just go to mypillow.com and click on the radio listener square and put in the secret code G-O-R-K-A. This offer won't last long. You won't regret it. They are the best slippers I have ever owned. And $90 off MyPillow.com. Do it today. Promo code G-O-R-K-A. I haven't rehearsed any of this with you, but I have things I want to ask you. You've talked about how you understood through your journeys, through your interviews, through our living together in a post-communist nation like Hungary, what socialism does to a nation. I mean, just how it breaks the back for generations. And we did our fair share. I did 15 years there, you did 12, and then we decided to move here. Will you talk a little bit about faith? Because you also found faith in your journey, and how you had lost your faith as a teenager. How did you capture it again, and what was that journey like for you?
Well, I have to say it was quite momentous. It was one of those really sort of direct encounters with God, honestly. I mean, it's a long story that I'm not going to recount here, but I really had a sort of direct experience of God during my travels in Romania, and then sort of one thing happened after another. I didn't quite fully recognize it at first for what it was. It took a little bit of time. And then, you know, thankfully, I had a spiritual director in New York who also supported that. And like little by little, I discovered my faith. And that was, I think, also a huge part of my coming to love America and understand America and to want to fight for America.
I've said this before, and I'd like you to help me with it, given that you have a different family history. But
you know my family history, parents who suffered as children under fascist occupation, then were persecuted under communism. My father arrested, tortured, given a life sentence at the age of 20, only to be liberated 6 years later from a political prison by the freedom fighters in 1956. Since living in America, we've been here 13 years now, at the beginning, I kind of used to poo-poo and make fun of the conservatives who said, socialism's coming, communism's coming. And I'm saying, really? Can I talk to you about the scars on my father's wrists from where they bound him together with wire to hang him from the ceiling of the torture chamber? That's communism. That's not coming to America. And I've had to do a public mea culpa on multiple occasions on this show in the last 3 years when I say, what we are witnessing right now makes me not make fun of those people anymore. And when people say communism is here, socialism is here, we shouldn't make fun of them. We should take it seriously. Your reaction?
Well, I would not necessarily call it communism. And I think it's sort of complicated because it was a very specific thing in Central and Eastern Europe. We don't have the police state.
But we have the FBI using counterterrorism tools against parents at school board meetings. We have Peter Navarro being putting leg shackles, leg irons at Reagan Airport because he doesn't recognize Nancy Pelosi's witch trial?
Yeah, we're definitely going down a very slippery and dangerous path. I mean, the fact that our leftist leadership is so willing to weaponize law enforcement against its political, not enemies, but its political opponents is terrifying. And, you know, one of the things that conservatives believe so deeply is you never want to implement a law when you're in power that could be turned against you if you were out of power.
Right.
And I think that's the really dangerous mistake that the Democrats are making. They're doing things right now. They're arrogant. They think that they've got all the power in the world, but it's going to be ugly if it gets turned against them. They will become the victims. And, you know, it's really interesting. You see this happening to so many people with cancel culture, right? You see people who are right there with it, supporting it, until they become the victim, because that's what happens.
Right.
They eat their own.
Yeah, the revolution eats itself,
yep.
Absolutely. You have a new phrase for who we're facing, not communists, not socialists. You and your colleagues, you've come up with something at Heritage. What do you call these people?
We call them next-gen Marxists. There's a whole debate whether things like critical race theory, is it really Marxist? And it's not entirely. There are differences, right? Marx saw the power relationship as really based on economic factors.
The material things.
The financial relationship between people. Today's Marxists see it as other things, identity, to do with identity. It's like your race or your sexual identity. But it's still all about power.
The shift from the material, you know, the oppression of the workers, to whether you're black or gay, they did that consciously because the material focus wasn't working.
Right.
This was a decision by them strategically to rewrap Marxism.
I mean, it was a decision to rewrap it, but then you did. I think you also had this other movement emerge. I'm going to say, I don't know if organically is the right way to put it, but, you know, people started to put two and two together. They saw that they could get traction by identifying issues like race or sexuality or gender and create these victim classes.
All right, guys, if you haven't done so already, make sure it is now a blockbuster, the most successful documentary in a decade. More than 1 million downloads in the first 6 days, more than 100,000 DVDs mailed out. We have to turn the Salem headquarters in California into a FedEx office because we were mailing out so many DVDs. It is Dinesh D'Souza's 2,000 Mules. You were told that you're a conspiracy theorist. It didn't happen. There's no evidence. Well, we've got it. I am vested in this. I've taken a personal stake in this because it's so important. petabytes worth of data, more than 4 million minutes of CCTV camera footage of the illegal ballot trafficking. You've got to see this movie right now. Buy the DVDs, share them. I've ordered another 10 DVDs to give to my friends. Go now to salemnow.com. It's 2,000 Mules. The work of True the Vote, Catherine Engelbrecht, Greg Phillips, is absolutely stunning. They filmed us, Salem hosts, reacting to the evidence, and it is truly shocking. Go today, salemnow.com, the movie 2,000 Mules. Spread the information, spread the evidence. Produced by the Salem Media Group, salemnow.com, 2,000 Mules.
Hi, everyone. If you've been injured in an accident that was not your fault, listen up. We have legal professionals standing by to answer your questions for free. Call now and find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth. Call 800-702-5400. I'm here with spokesman John Wolf. So, John, tell everyone listening who should call right now.
Well, Maria, first off, thank you for having me here. It's always nice to answer the listeners' questions. Now, as far as who should call in, anyone who's been injured in an accident and think you deserve compensation, give us a call right now. 800-702-5400. You'll find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth.
Thanks, John. You heard it, folks. Take advantage of this opportunity and call now. 800-702-5400.
Advertisement sponsored by Legal Help Center may not be available in all states.
So last week, it was on Thursday, we went to the school board meeting in Fairfax County. The amazing Epoch Times wrote up the event. I spoke there. It was not a bad turnout. It was in the midst of a thunderstorm. Thanks to everybody who came. God bless Stephanie, who organized it. We're going to talk about why you were there, why we were both there. But first, I want to play a little clip of Katie, my muse, speaking at the prior Fairfax County board meeting about a new regulation they're bringing in that is truly Marxist. Play cut.
No child should face discrimination for any reason, and we should support every effort to teach children to treat each other with kindness. But there is a vast difference between teaching tolerance and promoting gender fluidity. When a 12-year-old girl decides to remove her breasts, that is a decision she will live with for the rest of her life. When she takes heavy doses of testosterone, it causes irreversible damage. Why are you so keen to promote a very complex ideology on children? By forcing children to deny the visible and scientific reality of male and female, you are trying to mainline gender fluidity. You will ruin lives with such policies. You will deny children their First Amendment rights. You will confuse children. But worst of all, you will contribute to the irreversible mutilation of children's bodies. You are putting your own aggressive, progressive agenda ahead of the safety of our children.
Thank you for doing that, Katie. You are an inspiration to me and many, many others. After Thursday's meeting, the board voted 8-4 to approve a new regulation that is upon all the students of the richest county in America. Will you explain that new regulation and why it is so Marxist?
Yeah, the regulation is that children as young as kindergarten can be penalized if they use the wrong gender or if they use a child's former name.
Which is called, in their jargon, dead naming. So if a five-year-old Jimmy comes into school and says, "I'm Julie today and I'm a girl," and the kid that has been sitting next to him for a year says, "Hey, Jimmy," then you have transgressed, you have committed dead naming, and that child can be suspended.
Yep.
Correct?
Yes.
All right. Where is this coming from? Who's driving it? And talk to us about the parents' revolt. Are you excited in what you are witnessing, not just yourself, but others across the nation stand up?
Well, I have a tremendous colleague at Heritage named Jay Green, who's just come out with an amazing study on suicide rates amongst children, pushed through this gender ideology. And he's pointed out there was a very significant jump in 2015. I cannot tell you where this is coming from or who specifically is driving it. We know that there are various organizations driving it, but it's absolutely extraordinary how, and he points this out in his paper, and you can find this online at the Heritage Foundation, how essentially there was virtually no mention of gender transition or, you know, children in gender transition really up until about 2010. And then it started creeping up. And then there was this major jump in 2015. What's going on here? I mean, various people, you know, there are various arguments put forth. I mean, for one thing, it's very lucrative for the drug companies, for hospitals, for gender clinics. You know, it's a lot of money to put somebody through this surgery or through the treatment. What I don't understand, though, is why have schools embraced it so wholeheartedly? I mean, Fairfax County is just one school. We are getting stories from across the country of one of the things that's very, very common is that schools, they don't adopt new regulations because that would require scrutiny and discussion and voting. They simply adopt guidelines. And those guidelines say that if teachers feel that parents will not be supportive of a child's decision to transition to another gender, then the school can keep it a secret from parents.
Yeah, this is now a regulation in the state of Wisconsin, that if a child wants to quote-unquote transition, which is in fact physically, chemically impossible, you can't change the chromosomal makeup of a child, then they will not tell the parents if the child doesn't want to. We're talking about 12-year-olds, 10-year-olds.
Yeah. And there are a number of states that have introduced regulation, but in many more states, they managed to sort of slip this under the radar screen by simply calling it regulations. And I think a lot of parents have no idea. And this is what kind of upsets me.
What was that statistic you mentioned about the regulations and how few people read the email in Fairfax?
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Yeah. I mean, yes, parent revolt. I'm super excited. I love what groups like Moms for Liberty are doing. And the uprising going on across this country is huge. But Fairfax County, the school board sent out a survey, 180,000 students, only 2,000 families even responded to the survey.
Out of 100,000. Okay, guys, pay attention. It's happening right now in our schools. The children are being targeted. Parents need to stand up like Katie. Let your voice be heard because we outnumber the radicals. I don't know if I have permission to discuss this, but you and your colleagues, well, I do because you've stolen an idea from me. So I used to teach every course I did at the Defense University, teaching irregular warfare or grand strategy. I talk about this best case scenario case study of when America got it right, and that's the beginning of the Cold War. It starts with George Kennan, the classified, now declassified, long telegram he wrote from Moscow on why did the Soviets do what they do, which became his article, The Sources of Soviet Conduct. Then the response from Paul Nitz and his colleagues at the NSC, the NSC 68, which was the master plan for winning the Cold War, with other documents. You are now taking that scenario and looking at how do we defeat this next-gen Marxism. But there are challenges, are there not? Because in the Cold War environment, we're dealing with an enemy out there. It's a foreign entity that has declared war on us politically and otherwise. And now we have to deal with it domestically. So talk about how this is going.
Yeah, the thing is, in the successes that we had in fighting back against the Soviets, against Soviet disinformation, against their propaganda, their lies, you know, the same principles hold true today. What worked the best was exposing their lies and promoting the truth. Like Radio Free Europe, right? Huge success during the Cold War. And that's what they did. And that's what we need more of today. You know, we've got, you know, big problems where the left controls the media. They control the narrative. They control social media. They, you know, they cancel us if we try to say something on social media that doesn't jive with their narrative. we have to push back with the truth all the time. You know, I just want to mention, I had a great conversation with a woman that used to work for the CIA on these issues, tracking Soviet propaganda. She had a beautiful quote from somebody who's an expert on propaganda that said, propaganda ends where simple conversation begins, which I thought was very, very powerful. And her argument is, part of what we need to do is just start talking to each other again and not being afraid of the truth. So many of us have been too afraid to speak out about things like gender ideology or critical race theory or DEI. We cannot be afraid. When we're afraid, they win.
Yeah. I'm going to tell you a story from Thursday night's protest that I haven't even shared with you, and to get your reaction. So you were talking to somebody amongst the crowd, and I was slightly removed, giving an interview to the Epoch Times. And a car drives past us slowly with some students in it who had been part of the counter-protest, I guess, or had checked it out. And this fey-looking young man leans out of the window, earrings and whatever. And I was talking to the reporter about, you know, how this is communist. The idea that you're going to control the speech of children and punish them is like what happened under communism. And the kid leans out the window and says, "Communism? What's communism?" Like that. Either to provoke me or didn't know what communism is. And then I'm in the middle of an interview and I said, "No, well, yes, it is communism. Look it up, Google it." And then he says this, he says, "You don't like gays, do you?" And I thought, what do you say? I mean, clearly this is a 15-year-old kid who knows nothing about the 20th century, doesn't know that 100 million people died in the name of communism. And then he's at some counter-protest 100 feet away and has been told that we are there because we hate gay people. We have a lot of work to do, Katie, don't we?
Well, to be clear, the counter-protest was a pride protest.
Yes, I know.
Oh, okay.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. But when a kid says, "What's communism?" and "You hate gays,"
yeah,
then America has... this is an uphill battle, is it not?
It is an uphill battle.
Especially with that generation.
Yes. And the extraordinary thing, and I mean, you and I are guilty of this. The extraordinary thing is we still want to keep sending our kids to these colleges and universities because we want that degree for our child.
Yeah.
But they are getting indoctrinated. And, I really worry for this country, for what our kids are being taught. You know, I think parents are doing an incredible job of fighting this at the K through 12 level. But then we send them to college.
Yeah.
And we lose, all grip we have. Now, we've been really blessed because I think our son came out of college with his values intact. But, as you've talked about, we were utterly shocked on Sunday to hear in his graduation speeches, apologies for Western civilization.
From the head of the classics department in the first sentence of his graduation speech.
Yep.
Instead of congratulating the students on obtaining their majors in classics, he says, "I'm sorry about slavery."
Yeah. So I'm waiting to see now how parents are going to take on the college fight. I think that's what's got to happen next.
I think that the most powerful thing is, and please chime in here, it's the personal stories. You recommended to me, when I wrote my first book, the one that got me into the White House, Defeating Jihad, I was going to be a complete nerd and sit down and write my lectures that I do for the military on the Muslim Brotherhood, jihad, the history of jihad. And then you said to me, "Are you crazy? Nobody's going to read that book. You've got to explain why you're fighting the jihadis, how your belief system is based upon what your parents went through under fascism and communism, and how you see this as just another form of totalitarianism." So I took your advice. Every book I've written since then, the first chapter is always about my family and how they suffered under first the Nazis and then the communists. And wherever I go on the planet, if anybody's read the book, the only chapters they ever want to talk about are the personal chapters about my family. So it's the stories. It's the Morgan Zegers cataloging of the victims today from Cuba, from China, from North Korea. Isn't that how we're going to touch the hearts of the next generations?
Absolutely. And I think it's one of the great roles that, for example, Latinos can play in this country and that a lot of the new immigrants can play, because they have lived under communism, right? Now, the communist experience from the Soviet Union and Central and Eastern Europe is decades behind us, right? There are not so many people with that firsthand experience. But there are people coming here from Venezuela, from Cuba, from China even, from Russia. They need to be telling their stories. They need to be educating Americans about what communism is really like to live under. What does it look like when socialism is actually allowed to take power? And I think to some extent they are doing this. We need more of it. And that's why I say, you know, the dialogue, having the conversations with people. We all have to get out of our own little bubbles. We have to, I'm going to say, I think we need to get off our social media and get into conversation with our neighbors and just start changing hearts one person at a time.
Kind of ruined my next segue because I was going to talk about social media.
Oh,
please,
go on.
Please follow this lady, okay? I never mentioned it on the show. I always forget. We are everywhere except YouTube because they're a bunch of fascists. So follow me, Seb Gorka, on Twitter, on Instagram, on Facebook, on Truth Social, on Rumble. But this lady's most active on Facebook. She's on Twitter, but it's a cesspit, and I agree. So Catherine Gorka, that's K and two A's, K-A-T-H-A, Catherine Gorka on Facebook. Follow her. This is America First One-on-One. So last few minutes we have, I could go on for hours, and we will continue tonight for several hours and for several decades, I hope, if not many, many decades. What is your advice to those listening? Firstly, in terms of ammunition, in terms of things people should read and should do. If they shouldn't be on Twitter, what should they be reading? We love Imprimis. We love, you know, the conservative news sites. What classical books should they read? Should they read de Tocqueville? Should they read NSC 68? So how do parents understand what's happening? And then talk to us about what it takes to do what you do and where you find the courage to do it and what you say to those who are listening.
Yeah. Well, I'll say this. I was on a panel a few weeks ago with Tiffany Justice, one of the co-founders of Moms for Liberty. And I was the moderator, and I asked each of the panelists to tell me what was the hardest thing they had done. And she said the hardest thing she had ever done. Now, this is the co-founder of Moms for Liberty.
One of the most successful organizations in the last 2 years.
Yeah. They are just booming. But she said the hardest thing she'd ever done was get up and talk at a school board meeting.
Right.
Now, I had never done it till about 3 weeks ago, and I'm going to say, yes, I agree with her. I think it's the hardest thing I've ever done. You know, to be faced with this tribunal of 12 people who you know don't agree with you.
You've been press secretary for Customs and Border Patrol. You briefed the military, the intelligence community, and the school board was the toughest.
The school board was much scarier.
Because they're a bunch of Maoists, a bunch of extremists.
And you know they hate you, and you know that they all, you know, they're in lockstep with each other.
So get out of your comfort zone, number one.
Got to get out of your comfort zone.
What else do people need to do to get that armor on them?
I think staying up to date on the data, because it's changing rapidly. I can't say enough about Jay Green's paper that just came out.
We had him on the show last week.
Oh, good. Okay. Right. That's super important because it blows apart the narrative of the left. And I would just also say to people, trust what you know in your heart, because you know what's true and what isn't. And don't be cowed by this narrative of the left and they're trying to red pill us. And don't let it happen. Stand firm. Be loving, but be firm and stand up for it.
Why do you do what you do?
Because I love my country. And if not us, then who?
Yeah.
There is nowhere else to go.
There is nowhere else to go. It's Guan Cheng.
Chen Guancheng
has expressed it, the blind anti-abortion lawyer from China, when he escaped house arrest, hitchhiked across China. As a blind man to Beijing. There was only one door he wanted to knock on, and that was the door of our embassy. And there's no embassy door that you get to knock on, my friend, if America falls.
Yeah.
This is it. We have to become, once again, the shining city on the hill from the Old Testament, the one that Ronald Reagan reminded us of, because the loss of liberty, the extinction of liberty, is always but one generation away. I'm very grateful to Katie, my muse. You've been listening to America First. Follow her. Join the Heritage Foundation, heritage.org. Wherever you are, whatever you're doing, keep your head on a swivel. Watch your six. Hold the line. Never give up. Never give in. And stay frosty.
Brought forth upon this continent a new nation conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal.
I know not what course others may take, but as for me, give me liberty or give me death.
The world will little note or long remember what we say here, but it can never forget what they did here.
I have a dream.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
I can hear you. The rest of the world hears you. And the people...
This is America First with Sebastian Gorka.
But I never called Mike Pence a wimp. I never called him a wimp. Mike Pence had a chance to be great. He had a chance to be, frankly, historic. But just like Bill Barr and the rest of these weak people, Mike, and I say it sadly because I like him, but Mike did not have the courage to act. Bill Barr was afraid of certain things, and you know what they were. Please don't impeach me. Don't impeach me, Bill Barr. Please. I said, what's wrong with being impeached? I got impeached twice, and my poll numbers went up. I don't want to be impeached, sir. I don't want to be impeached.
That was at the Faith and Freedom Coalition, I think, on Friday. That was my former boss, President Trump. Still got his sense of humor and probably still knows how to ride a bicycle better than Joe Biden. I'm Sebastian Gorka. This is America First, coming to you live from the ReliefFactor.com studios. I have you. Hope you had a wonderful Father's Day weekend. I guess it's a federal holiday today. Our studio is in a building where there are government offices. The post office has a whole floor, a whole story. The Department of State has two stories, I think. Jeff, when you rolled into work today, what was the percentage of cars in the garage under our offices?
That's the first thing I thought. I'm like, what is going on? I said, does nobody just work now? Because these weekends get longer and longer in the summer. And then I realized that it was Juneteenth. It's completely empty.
Right. It's less than 10%, right?
It's like when your first show, we did it on January 1st when we worked New Year's Day. That's what it reminded me of.
Exactly. And it is so, I mean, this is the swamp. This is D.C., especially Fridays, just regular Fridays. The car park is half empty. Why? Because, they work for the U.S. government. We don't. We just rent space in a building where the U.S. government is pretending to work, or at least some of them are. So much news to discuss with you. Let's just rattle off a couple of headlines. Hillary has made a decision about running in 2024, and I think it's going to surprise you. Do we trust her? Of course we don't. Never trust Hillary Clinton. When it comes to the current incumbent in the White House, he has sunken with an approval rating standing now at 32%. Guys, I just want to know, call in. Who are the 32% in this nation? Who are the 32% of Americans who approve of this guy? And I want to know, who gave him a bicycle? Who thought giving this 79-year-old man who doesn't even know which arm to swing forward with, which leg when he's walking, a bicycle? And not just a bicycle, at least they could have given him a trike or a bicycle with trainer wheels. They gave him one with the toe clips on the pedals. Are you kidding me? Secret Service, you know that was sabotage, don't you? In case you missed it, in case you've been in a cave all weekend, let's play that cut. This is the man who is always 30 feet away from the nuclear football, the capacity to actually launch Armageddon. Do we have that clip? Yes, cut three, play cut. Boom! And he's down. And then after church on Sunday, he did a a very strange kind of double-footed hop when somebody asked him if he's okay. All right, sorry, I got carried away there. Got to get back to the breaking news. Let's talk about the very disturbing latest evidence coming out of Uvalde. I'm going to give you the headlines. We'll discuss these later. We'll get your takes. The call board is lighting up. Only two lines left already, and we're, what, 4 minutes into the show? The number is 833-33-GORKA. That's 833-334-6752. Headline from the Daily Wire. Video shows police never tried to open door to get into Texas classroom where shooter was. Let me read that again. Video shows police never tried to open door to get into Texas classroom where the shooter was. We'll give you more details, but the biggest piece of news... truly, you may think I'm exaggerating, but in terms of winning the culture war, there was a World Swimming Championships in Budapest, and on the fringes of the meeting, FINA, which is the regulatory board for international swimmers, brought a decision about transgenders. And I'm going to read to you from ESPN, of all places. Headline, FINA votes to restrict transgender women from elite swimming competition. This is the sign, this is the first volley in a fusillade that proves that the good guys are winning. Swimming's world governing body, FINA, FINA, on Sunday voted to restrict the participation of transgender athletes in elite women's competitions and create a working group to establish an open category for them, for the transgender athletes in some events as part of its new policy. Okay, you want to be trans? You want to pretend you're a girl? Fine. You're not going to swim with the real girls. You can go off on your own special category. The new policy, which takes effect Monday, busy, right? Decide Sunday, takes effect Monday. We like these guys. Will require transgender competitors who have completed their transition by age 12 to be able to compete in women's competitions. Now, what does this mean? It means there will be no transgender athletes, because nobody's transitioned fully by the age of 12. So it's clever. It's super clever. Quote, this is the official line after the decision. This is not saying that people are encouraged to transition by the age of 12. It's what the scientists are saying. If you transition after the start of puberty, you have an advantage, which is unfair. End quote from James Pierce, the spokesman for FINA. It's absolutely right. I mean, if it weren't insane to even consider transition, the idea that you transition after puberty, like Leah Thomas, well, guess what? You have the advantage, the larger skeletal structure, the heavier density of muscles. This way, it obviates all of that. They're not saying everyone should transition by 11. That's ridiculous. You can't transition by that age in most countries, and hopefully you won't be encouraged to. Basically, what they're saying is that it is not feasible for people who have transitioned to compete without having an advantage. Nailed it. Nailed it. The regulations, this is now back to the article, would have a major impact on the career of Leah Thomas, who earlier this year became the first openly transgender woman, you mean man, to win a NCAA Division I women's title. Responding to the new decision, she said, of course ESPN would say she said, you hacks. What are his chromosomes, ESPN? If they're XY, he ain't a she. The response from Leah Thomas: the new FINA release is deeply upsetting. It is discriminatory and will only serve to harm all women. No, Leah. It will only harm fake women like you, who were ranked 423rd in the men's league nationally and were so crap at swimming and so jealous at what their elder brother was doing in the swim team that you decided to cheat,
So you changed your name, grew your hair long, and decided that you are now a girl. Well, you're not. You're a boy, you're a man, and you always will be until they put you in the ground because your chromosomes cannot change. My gosh, congratulations to Fina. There are some brave people left. Is that it? Is that all I've got? 11 minutes already? That's crazy. I'm Sebastian Gorka. This is America First, coming to you from the ReliefFactor.com studios. Make sure you are subscribed to the podcast. Go to Spotify, put in my name, America First. Write us a review, share the links, and guarantee that you never, ever miss an episode.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.